Thanks very much, Alec. And I'm actually, you mentioned Jeff Johnson. There's the Nedbank South African Golf Challenge, which is taking place tomorrow. And thankfully, my son is playing in my place, and he's a far better golfer than me. And he's got a whole lot of friends, so we're able to support it because I could be here. But thank you for those kind words. And Simon Marais was certainly an extremely special man, a wonderful man, unbelievably humble. And, you had to work with him to just know his clarity of thought and his deep intellect. But he never portrayed that, you know, in terms of, he never told you about the fact that he, you know, was a doctor at Cambridge and all the rest. Amazing man. And I learned a lot from Simon, and I'm very grateful for my time for working with him. So he lives on in our hearts and minds. Thank you, Alec. Right. So unfortunately, I have got a few presentations, and I'm going to start with some maths. I thought it'd be a good way to start, but it's only one slide. And the reason I want to start with this is that you often hear us analysts and portfolio managers talking about relative. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, what we do is we take a company or a region or an index, and we divide it by the other, and we compare it to another company region index. So you can say, how's Pick and Pay doing versus ShopRite? How's ShopRite doing versus the retail sector? How's the retail sector doing versus the market? And so what do we do there? We divide the one by the other. So let's pretend you've got two companies. They're both 100. So you've got 100 divided by 100. But the top one goes up 10%. ShopRite goes up 10%. Pick and Pay doesn't move. Okay, you've got 110 over 100. If you simplify it, one goes to 1.1. And let's put it on the chart. One, you can see an upward sloping line. And so when you see an upward sloping line, what you should know is that the company on the top of the numerator has outperformed the denominator. Okay? So let's just put that into a chart. What you have here is the MSCI Value Index divided by the MSCI Growth Index since the start back in late 1974. Value outperformed when the line was sloping up, and value has underperformed since late 2007. And so that is the backdrop. And just to explain, why has value underperformed? And I really think there are three reasons which are not often explored, and I'd like to just touch on the three reasons. The first is, let's look at interest rates. Okay, there's that same chart I showed you a second ago. I want to overlay that with the two-year treasury yield. Now, bond yields bounce around based on inflation in the US, etc. And so up until 2008, October 2008, the average two-year interest rate in the States was just under 7%. Okay? And then what happened is the Fed, in response to the global financial crisis and the mortgages that Si mentioned a few minutes ago, to try and save the financial system, injected a huge amount of money in through a process called quantitative easing. Okay, so there we go. October 2008, the Fed announced these quantitative easing packages, which continued until late 2021. Interest rates collapsed because of this injection of money. And for the period when quantitative easing was in place, the average two-year treasury bill was 0.89%. Okay, the QE ended in November 2021. The Fed announced that they were going to slow down their bond buying. Interest rates rallied, and they're currently just under 4. Now, what do you notice? You notice that value underperformed growth when interest rates were so low. And there's a reason for that. And that is that if you invest in a company like Amazon and they're promising you $100 of earnings in 10 years' time and interest rates are naught, that $100 that you're going to get in 10 years' time is worth $100 now. But as soon as you have higher interest rates, that $100 is not worth $100, is worth far less because of the discount rate. Okay, so it makes complete sense that growing companies did really well during times of low interest rates. So that's the first reason. Okay, the question is then, well, what about, yeah, but hang on, interest rates are 4%, and you can see in that little circle, values underperform growth. What's going on there? Well, that's the AI frenzy we saw, okay, which may be coming to an end. Let's talk about that in a sec. So the second reason is you had rapidly growing companies. And what I've got here on this chart, the blue line is Microsoft's share price. The purple bars are Microsoft's earnings per share. And you can see they went from basically $2 in 2016 to currently $12. Okay, so the earnings went up sixfold. I've just chosen Microsoft. I could have put them all on top, but Apple's earnings went up, Nvidia's earnings, Google's earnings or Alphabet's earnings, Amazon's earnings. The same story, okay? These technology companies were growing fast. And because the technology earnings were growing fast, companies, they were being rated at a higher price earnings ratio, because of the interest rates I just mentioned. All right? And the third reason is this money poured into ETFs, poured into passive funds. And when I started Ranmore back in late 2008, there was just under $1 trillion in passive ETFs. There's now over $10 trillion in equity ETFs. Okay, so that has been this wave, of tsunami of money pouring into passive funds. Now, let's just put all those things together, because this wave of money that has been pouring into passive funds, and what are those passive funds invested in? Those large technology companies. And those large technology companies were being rated highly because of the interest rates. And so what does that mean? Well, there's Microsoft's earnings and share price. But what you'll notice is that the scale on the right is different to the scale on the left. So let's put them on the same scale. Okay, I've made the right-hand scale 1/10 of the left-hand scale. And what that basically shows is that if Microsoft's share price had gone up at the same rate of earnings, that blue line would have tracked the purple bars, and you'd have a Microsoft share price of around $150, $130, okay? But it hasn't. It's now over $400. And so Microsoft has gone from a P of 13.5 to a P of 38, okay? So you've had, so people think, oh, well, Microsoft's gone up because the earnings have gone up. Yeah, that's one reason. But actually, that only accounts for 22% of the share price. 66% of the share price is a re-rating of those earnings, because those earnings were 13.5 times, they're now 38 times. Okay, so it's those three factors together that I think we all need to be aware of. You've had these fast-growing companies that are getting really highly rated at the same time as money has been pouring into the passive funds and investing largely in those companies, and that's a problem. So amidst all of this, what is really interesting is that in July, value outperformed growth by 5.7%. And you go, well, how on earth could that be? All right, let's go back and look at what months value has really outperformed growth to that extent. And so what I did is I went back and I got monthly data back to 1974, and those are the 15 best months that value had. Let's look at where they were. They're in those red dots. Okay, I took the 15 months where value outperformed the most, and I popped them on the red dots. And you can see, now what you can see is you can see some clusters, but they're largely at turning points just after value starts to do really well, okay? The problem with monthly data is that we all know that if, and this is why I disregard monthly data really, is that sometimes if the month ended a couple of days later or a couple of days earlier, it's a different picture. Okay, it's completely, I mean, just look at this last August when Japan had that big fall on the, 1st or 2nd of August. If the month of July just ended a couple of days later, different story. So what I then said is, okay, well, this is interesting. This is really interesting. Let me go and see if I can get daily data. But I couldn't get daily data going back to 1974. They never used to provide that data. So I managed to get, and on that, if you had bought value after those red dots, and held for 2 years, your average outperformance would have been minus 1.2%, okay? But you outperformed by 7%, meaning growth went down by, 8.3%. Okay, so value kind of preserved capital, but you massively outperformed. And that's why I wanted to explore it a little more. So I got this daily data and I said, okay, well, let's go back, but we're mindful of when months end. Let's look at 5-day rolling data. It's like a week. But not just, we look at a week and then we move it forward by a day and then we move that week forward, et cetera, from 1999, still 25 years of data. And what I'd seen is that on the 17th of July, the 5 days leading up to the 17th of July, value had outperformed by 6%. And I then said, well, how many times has that happened? It's only happened 11 times. It was the 11th best. So then I played that same did that same analysis on rolling data, okay, rolling daily data. And look where my dots are, okay, again, at those turning points, and especially when you get clusters. So I thought, oh, well, that's really interesting. My average 2-year outperformance was minus 1.6, but my average 2-year performance is up 15. So growth went down 16%, okay? And what I think this actually means is that for value to do well in an environment that shouldn't be suiting value with interest rates and all the rest, okay, is that is that there's too many people on one side of the boat. Picture a boat. All your crew are on one side of the boat. The boat's very unstable. You don't need much of a wave to capsize the boat, okay? And as soon as you get a bit of a shock, like the Bank of Japan or whatever, it causes people to readjust and say, you know what, maybe we should get a bit more evenly spread. But I took it a step further. I said, that's value growth. What about mid-cap, large-cap? All right, here's mid-cap and large-cap, the turning points. You can see mid-caps outperformed from 1999. They've massively underperformed in recent years. 17th of July, same story. You got the same story. The mid-caps had a huge surge against large-caps. I said, well, let's put that together. Let's find an index. What about mid-cap value and large-cap growth? Okay. And just look at those numbers. Mid-caps up 20%, average outperformance 9.5. So again, quite meaningful. Putting those two together, I found the S&P 400 mid-cap value and compared it to the S&P 500 large-cap growth. Okay. And look what you see here. Again, mid-cap value massively underperformed. Look where the red dots are at those turning points. And the numbers are a bit ridiculous. Two-year absolute performance, 42%. Two-year relative performance, 53%. Now, I'm not for a second suggesting that mid-cap value is going to outperform to that extent. But you heard Pete earlier when Alec asked, when did this happen? And Pete used that example in early 2000s. This is not impossible because there's been such a wave of money that has moved into these trillion-dollar companies. You just need a little bit of that, just a little bit, to say, you know what, I think we've squeezed most of the juice of this lemon. Let's move on to the other side of the boat. Let's take our U.S. weighting down from 70% to 60%. And just that little move, you start to get their smart money, the hedge funds, the sovereign wealth funds, family offices, etc. I mean, the individuals investing in passives will probably be the last ones to move. But you just get a few of those and you can see some dramatic numbers, okay? No surprise, where are we finding value because of those underperformance? What you've got here is the Morningstar style box. And if you're looking at a fund, go and look on Morningstar's website. It's a great chart. And it shows you value, blend, growth, large, mid, small. And we're the blue dot. Most of our competitors you can see blue dot, mid-cap value. Most of our competitors are large-cap growth. And they have to be. They're so large, they can't move to size point. You know, if you're 500 billion, you just can't move. You have to be invested in those companies. And the question is, and there's my boat. You know, everybody is long U.S., they're long large-cap, they're long growth companies, and they're short emerging markets, mid-cap, and value. Okay, they've ignored those. And because they've been ignored for such a long period of time, that is where we are finding exceptional value. All right. How much, you know, how heavily weighted are they? Well, if you go onto Morningstar, you can see there's 959 large cap growth funds. There's 120 large cap value funds. Not many. 90% of that little universe is growth, you know, 12% or whatever it is, 11% is value. So you can just see, and that's just the number of funds. That's not even the size of the funds. So you can see that most people are on that one side of the boat. Okay, this is our you can see our green is what our weightings are in regions, and the blue is what the MSCI World Index is. You can see World Index 73%, I think it is, in US. Practically nothing in Hong Kong or China, etc. So we're far more evenly spread than the world index. And let's look and see, let's bring it back to value. Is there a rationale? Is there a reason why you could expect a huge move? Well, the MSCI large cap growth, the forward multiple's 27. Okay, that's high. Dividend yield 0.7%, 8x book. The mid cap value 14, it's half the value. Okay, ours is we're running at a six times earnings, 4.2% dividend yield. One times book. And we try and stay away from value traps. So these are not six times earnings with earnings about to fall in a heap. We think they're six times earnings where they're actually growing a bit. And you can do that if you look around the world. You can certainly do that. Now, don't take my word for it that valuation matters. This is from JP Morgan's book, and they put out a fabulous publication. You should go and look for it online. And what this shows here is the S&P 500, and what you have on the x-axis is the PE multiple, the forward PE multiple, and on the y-axis, the subsequent 10-year returns. And what do you notice? The less you pay, the higher your returns. Valuations matter, okay? We've come out of this environment where, yeah, but you know, those companies have done well. They're fabulous companies. No one is denying that they're not fabulous companies. The question is, can we make a return from this price? And I would argue, no, you can't. Now, the third thing, you know, is growth in the price. And I thought this was quite interesting. This is NVIDIA's chart, which has obviously been incredible. They had great results recently. And how good were those results? Revenue was up 122%. Earnings were up 168%. Amazing. Okay. In fact, they were so good that all these brokers, 10 brokers, all raised their target price. Needham, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, the whole lot. They all raised the target price. What did the share price do? Fell. It's down 16%, 15%. It was up a bit yesterday. And that just tells me that when the news is so good and everybody is raising target prices, but yet it still falls, you're the buyers. The buyers have filled their boots. They're done. I mean, the price is gone. If anything, you're now at the point where people who bought ages ago are taking profits. Okay, and you've seen that in the last earnings season. We saw Microsoft good results, stock was weak. We saw Alphabet great results, stock was weak. Okay, it's becoming more and more in the price. And it just tells me, from a supply and demand thing, everybody knows these stories. Who doesn't know Microsoft is a great company? And so, really, what is my summary? QE is over, and that is good for value investing, and value investing makes sense. Earnings growth may finally be in the share price. Yeah, maybe I'm a couple of quarters too early. We'll see. Okay, but we're in injury time where the clock is ticking. Valuations matter. It's not just my view. JP Morgan, you saw that data there. That valuations matter. We've just forgotten it in recent years. And mid-cap value looks compelling for many reasons, especially if growth is hard to come by for those large companies. One way in which they can grow earnings is to go and acquire the smaller ones. Okay. And so the point being, when you're looking at your own portfolios, you know, talk to your advisor, just be careful that you're not on the same side as everybody else. If you've got a portfolio full of household names that everybody knows about, you probably are. Go and have a look at the Morningstar, look at the PE ratios of the funds you're invested in, make sure you're not in all those companies, because when the sheep try and leave the field, some are going to get trampled. And that would be my, that's it.
Thank you, Sean. Sounded like you were at an investment conference. You got your microphone there. Bottom lining it, we have heard today America's expensive. We've heard today America's in a difficult place. Tsai is terrified by whoever becomes the next president. We've also heard today that South Africa's cheap. And you've said here, and that is South African stocks. We've done American stocks, South African stocks. We've also heard here that where you buy or what you buy, the time you buy is very important. Overlaying all of this, the Obas van Omaha, Warren Buffett, has got $267 billion in cash. In other words, like, what, 40% of his portfolio sitting in cash money, not invested in the stock market. It's almost a little bit of a no-brainer. There's a problem going to happen sometime, and the insiders, yourself, Warren Buffett, Pitt, Tsai, are warning us, waving big flags. But what might, how can we believe that you're right and that the markets, which are not showing, are wrong?
I think the markets are starting to show us. You know, you look at, I quite like charts, okay? Because charts help me work out supply and demand. I mean, what other way have you got to work out supply and demand? Go and do yourself a favor. Go and have a look at the S&P 500. You've got a double top.
Now, all right. Now, I'm going to stop you because there are people here saying, yes, what's this act talking about? What is the S&P 500?
S&P 500 index, which is that index of, you know, of the largest companies. But the point
companies
in the S and, well, in the US.
Okay.
I mean, okay. So
by what measure?
Well, market cap.
What's right. market cap?
It's the share price multiplied by the number of shares. But so it's the size of the companies.
The value of the company.
The value of the company.
So okay. What you're saying is you're taking the 500 most valuable American companies. I hope you're all following this now, because I know there were lots of people sitting there, hey, glazed eyes. We're now getting back to, seriously, Sean, okay. let's keep it real. The 500 most valuable companies on the American stock market make up this thing called the S&P 500 index.
Yes.
And that index is showing us that the stock markets or those share prices are expensive.
It's showing us that it's running out of demand, I think. Okay? And it's running out of demand because you've got big guys like Warren Buffett selling Apple. And we don't know. He might have actually carried on selling. We'll find out at the next set of results. But why has he sold Apple? Well, he says it's because of for tax reasons. But also, if there was massive upside, okay, potential return from this point, well, he wouldn't have sold. Okay, so the problem is Apple is it's hard for these companies to grow. They're making hundreds of billions of net income. It's really difficult for them to grow, and they're all competing. I mean, Nvidia's largest customers, Apple, Microsoft, Meta, all those guys, are all developing their own chip. They're all competing. They're trying to make their own chip so that they don't have to pay these crazy prices from Nvidia.
Quite a few people have been talking about Nvidia.
Yeah.
What is Nvidia?
Well, I mean, they're a chip manufacturer in a $3 trillion chip manufacturer in the States. Okay. Valued at 36 times sales. In other words, if they had no costs and paid no tax and paid 100% of its earnings and dividends were at this high level forever, it would take you 36 years to get your money back. Now, no sensible business person is going to pay 36 times. You know, if I had a restaurant and I sold 100,000 or a million rands worth of sales, you wouldn't come pay 36 million rand for my business. It would take you 36 years to get your money back if you had no costs of goods and no staffing and no tax, etc. So it's a huge number, okay? And so this frenzy has built to this huge point where I think the market is running out of demand, because you're now starting to see the value index hit a new high last month, growth didn't.
But now do you see the problem that most people have?
Okay.
Because you guys are talking at this level, and most people are looking at this level, and they don't know what growth and value and Nvidia and 36 times sales and all of this stuff is. So what I'm trying to tease out of you is what could happen if you've got your money invested in these American shares and all the insiders like you guys and Warren Buffett know something bad's going to happen, but we, as the normal people, keep putting our money in there. How much of that can we lose?
You know, we don't. Well, you heard the numbers that Pete was quoting after the tech bubble burst last time. I'm suggesting the tech bubble is going to all burst. What I'm saying is the odds of making a return from here on those expensive companies is not worth it, because you can lose too much. You know, you only want to invest if you can make twice. Let's say you invest 100. Well, I want to make 200, and I don't want to lose more than 50. Do you know what I mean? Because you've got to get you're not going to get everyone right. And so you've got to make sure the odds are on your side. That's what you have to do. You know, what can I make and what can I lose? And if you can lose more than you can make, it's not a good investment. I think right now you can lose more than you can make.
Okay, so yeah? Sean, you started Randmore 2008. You've been in this market for a long time. You've worked with Simon Maria. You and Andrew are doing an amazing job. This guy's in the top 1% of fund managers in the world. That's probably why he talks the way that he does, because you talk to...
I was trying to keep it simple. I'm sorry that it's...
Just hear me out. So make it simple for us.
All right.
Make it simple. I've put $100. I've got $100 invested in the American stock market. By your calculations, what could that fall to, or what could it go up to if you have a look at it from a broad average?
You know, Alec... That's a hard question to answer. But what I'm saying is there's no safety in familiar names.
If you bought Nike a while ago thinking, oh, it's a great company, I like their running shoes, I see their brand everywhere, I've heard of the brand, you lost, I don't know, 40% of your money in the last couple of years. If you bought Estee Lauder because you go, oh, well, that's a familiar brand, I know, you know, I recognize the name of the company, you're down 70%. If you bought Diageo, you know, you're down 40%. So one's got to be very careful. Don't confuse familiar names, okay, with the fact that I'm safe. That's a great company for the long run. Who knows? Nike could easily get overtaken by On Running and Hoka and Skechers and those kind of guys. Okay, the world is constantly changing. Go look at the, I mean, Pete mentioned the 50-50. Those were 50 companies that everybody thought were safe would never go down. I'm telling you exactly there now. People don't think that Apple's ever going to fall or, you know, that that Nvidia could ever be, you know, overtaken. Well, we got these Chinese guys. I mean, the company we're talking about just now with robo-taxis, you know, that's Baidu, that Chinese company that's got superior I mean, Tesla have licensed Baidu. We've got Baidu in our top 10. Okay. Differences is less than 10 times earnings.
Explain that relative to Tesla.
Well,
nice and basic, simple.
What Baidu is basically the Chinese Google. Okay. China has got, I mean, Google has got Waymo, which is their automated driving. And Baidu's got their robo taxi business. Their robo taxi business is so good that Tesla has licensed its technology for Teslas in China. Okay? But the difference is you can pay whatever crazy number you want to pay for Tesla. You can go buy Baidu on less than 10 times earnings with, you know, half the market cap in cash or thereabouts. So that is the point. So
how much cheaper? How much cheaper? When you say half the market cap in cash, you're losing people again. How much, if you got one Tesla worth 100, how much is Baidu, one Baidu worth relative?
Cents. Almost cents in the dollar. It's like a tenth of the price or something. You know?
How does it get so out of...
Well, because nobody wants to buy China. And what was Pete talking about earlier? Go where nobody wants to go. That's how we make a return. We don't buy the popular stuff that everybody wants to buy because if everybody wants to buy it, well, it's already in the price. It's already... It's like trying to buy a Bantry Bay apartment in the middle of December on a sunny day when the foreigners are here with their checkbooks, okay? You're not going to get a good price. If you want to buy a Bantry Bay apartment, go to a deceased estate in the middle of winter, you know, estate agent, and then you got to get a good, and find a property with that hasn't been given a coat of paint in 40 years. Then you'll get a good price, okay? But you're going to have to go to a few estate agents. So that's the thing. So you've got to look, if you want to look for value, and value everybody, who doesn't like a bargain? That's why value investing makes sense. I mean, everybody wants a bargain. You want to go on holiday, you go and want to book a ticket on the airplane, you're going to look for the best price. Okay? So because we all know that value makes sense, but then it comes to the market and it's, yeah, but value's underperformed. I don't want to go there. Okay? And the interesting thing though, you know, is that if you want to compare funds, you look at the last 3 years, that's during the post-quantitative easing. You look at 5 years, maybe that's a little bit of...
Before. I've got to stop you.
Okay.
It's quantitative easing.
All right.
What is quantitative easing?
That is what central banks did to inject money into the economy. They bought bonds, effectively. By buying bonds that, you know, from insurance companies and those kinds of things, they injected money in.
But what did it mean?
It meant that interest rates fell.
It meant they created money.
Created money.
They just magicked up money because they bought... with a balance sheet that is infinite.
Yeah.
So in essence, quantitative easing was a system where America and Europe and Japan. UK and China as well.
Japan
as well. Magicked up money, pushed that into the system, and that money had to go somewhere.
Correct.
Now that's ended. And the consequence of that is what you're outlining for us now. Whoops. It ain't going to be going up anymore. In fact, we've inflated to these levels. We've got to kind of come back to earth. Is that what I'm reading?
Yeah. I mean, things change. The world is constant. I don't look back and say, well, that happened the last 20 years. That's what's going to be like in the next 20 years. You know, New Zealand used to be an incredible rugby team for 20 years. And now we beat them 2 on the row. Things change.
First time since 1949. We must get it.
There we go. I know. But I think it is, you know, when we look at examples like that, it just reminds us that history is interesting, but it's not, don't expect it to be exactly the same going forward. And the markets are no different.
Okay, the markets are no different.
Now, everyone's sitting here thinking, okay, now I got this inside information, but I know last time somewhere at the golf course told me some inside information didn't work out so well. How can we be comfortable that everybody doesn't know this already and that what you're telling us now isn't everybody else is actually heading for the exits, or the smart money is heading for the exits and we might be caught?
Oh, I think the smart money is heading for the exports, and that's why you got those red dots. That's why you got those red dots, okay? How does value massively outperform in this environment by 5% over 6% over 5 days? Because people are heading for the exits, okay? That's the smart money is heading for the exits and repositioning. That's what I think. Might be wrong, might be too early, but if you look at all those things, that's what it suggests to me. And it's not inside information. I mean, you know, inside information is you know some secret information that you shouldn't really know, and that's market movie. This is public information.
Yeah, well, it's public, but not everybody listens. No, that's what I mean.
And
why is it that the public's not being told this? Why is it that the public's being told, put your money into these assets because it's gone up by so much in the past, it's going to, you know, the implication is it's going to continue rising.
So Alec, you'll know well the Warren Buffett thing, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful, okay? I put it another way. Sometimes you've got to do what feels difficult, because if it feels easy, well, then everyone's going to do it. So, you know, it's difficult to be greedy when others are fearful. It's difficult to be fearful when others are greedy, okay? Now, imagine you're an advisor and you come along and you go, listen, I think you should take your money out of this fund, which has got Nike and Diageo and Microsoft, and put it in this value fund that you've never, with a whole lot of companies you've never heard the names of. How difficult? What do you think the client's going to say? Must be joking. You know? So this is why it's much easier to say, oh, come on, let's go to the passives. Look at all these wonderful companies. They're great companies. Of course, they're great companies. Do you know that Intel's at the same share price as it was in 1997? Okay? 1997. It's our losing money, hemorrhaging cash. They're nowhere. They're spending all this CapEx. 1997. This is Intel. At the time in 1997, their revenue, I think, was twice the next competitor. I mean, they were selling, I think, $20 billion. Is that right? $20 billion of revenue. Multiples of any of the other. I mean, after the next one, if you look at the top 10, I mean, there were multiples of the last five. Okay? That is how, in an unassailable position, Intel appeared to be. Roll forward from 1997 to 2024, it's not the same share price, and it's lost its lead, it's losing market share, it's hemorrhaging cash, it's a mess. So one's got to be careful. One's got to be careful. And, you know, it's like, how much pain can you stomach? And I'm all for everybody investing for themselves, but how much of your pension do you want to manage yourself? Okay? Because I think that's quite an important question. Are you going to manage the whole lot?
Oh, and unfortunately, in this country, many people have asked some big names to manage money for them, and that has gone nowhere in 10 or 15 years. So after inflation, they've been going backwards. So it's fine to say, let someone else manage it. But if you've got a track record that stinks that badly, no wonder people are skeptical.
But then I think one just needs to be very cautious, because you can get some of these prices correcting quite sharply. I mean, if there's a problem with Taiwan Semiconductor tomorrow, okay, or we wake up and China's invaded, I mean, and you've got NVIDIA, I don't know, what could have fallen, 25% in one day? You know, how are you going to feel? Warren Buffett says only buy a share if you can imagine it falling 50%. I think it's a good rule. And if you can stomach it falling 50% and you know you can still sleep at night and your partner won't hate you, okay, then, which I think is it's a factor, then that's fine. Go ahead. But if you... But there's a famous trader from way back when, a guy called Jesse Livermore, and somebody once said to him, I might have told the story before, somebody once said to him, Jesse, what do I do? I'm long cotton and I can't sleep at night. And he says, you need to sell down to the sleeping position. Okay, and that's good advice. So, you know, we've got to be able to stomach some losses, because this is a... And I just think it's at the time when everybody rolls out that quote, be greedy, everyone's fearful. Yeah, but nobody tells people, listen, everyone's greedy, It's time to be fearful. So we all roll out that quote when the markets are falling. Nobody rolls out the quote when the market's at the highs. Okay? And I just think that, you know, and to Sy's point about the election, I think he's right. I think there's lots of risks. If Trump loses, do you think he's going to take it, you know, lying down? No ways. I mean, it is really remarkable what South Africa has managed to achieve. It really is. And you can just, the Americans are so divided. You know, there's 400 million guns in that place, and half the population are not happy. Half the population is not going to be happy with the outcome. It's quite a worry. And why do you want to have 70% of your money there? So, you know, anyway.
Okay.
Not to be dramatic.
So, not to be dramatic. Sean, before we go to these questions from the tribe, just help me a little bit about the bottom lining of all of this information that you've absorbed. Now, remembering, Sean started and runs his own business. Sy started and runs his own business. Pitt started and runs his own business. They don't answer to boards of directors and marketing committees who tell them to go and tell a particular story. They only answer to those people who they serve in the same way as we answer to those people we serve. So now, bottom line it for us. What should a man in the street investor, apart from giving their money to Rand Moore to run, they're going to keep some of it for themselves because they're feeling a bit nervous about what's happened in the last 15 years. How should they be spreading their risk of their investments?
Well, I think you saw from the chart up there, mid-cap value is underloved.
And what is mid-cap value?
Well, mid-sized companies, you know. The challenge for individual investors is many of these companies you probably wouldn't have heard of, you know. But emerging markets is out of favor.
What is emerging markets?
Places like Hong Kong. Well, actually, Hong Kong's a developed market, but I mean, many Chinese companies are listed in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is very out of favor. Brazil is out of favor. South Africa's out of favor. And everybody just wants to pour money into the Microsofts of the world. And what I'm saying is you don't have to go there. You know, you don't have to go there. I'll talk about it. This ABN AMRO is in our top 10. And I know I've mentioned it before. But what's interesting yesterday was it was announced that UniCredit had acquired a stake in Commerzbank. And all of a sudden, everybody went, oh, hang on a second. These European banks are trying to merge and acquire each other. Okay. Well, ABN AMRO could be in its sights. It's not, you know, it's quite well known that Deutsche Bank looked at ABN AMRO. ABN AMRO gives you an 8% dividend yield. It's trading on 6 times, which means that if the stock price doesn't do anything, you're going to get 8%, which means you're going to beat inflation just from the dividend. Okay. Now, if they grow earnings, well, I can get a little bit of earnings growth, and it's on 6 times earnings. So why shouldn't it be, and 0.6 times book? So, you know, if it just went back to
what is 0.6 times book?
Means that if it's got if you you know, collected your creditors and paid all your debtors in the shut up shop, you get 100. Okay. Well, you're currently buying that 100 for 60.
So you're buying a dollar's worth of value for 60 cents.
Correct. Which means that if it goes back to book, and let's see, means you make 40 on 60, which is 60% return. I'm not suggesting you make 60% return on ABN AMRO, but I'm saying that there's upside there. You don't have to take this risk with the NVIDIA. I'm not getting any dividend from those companies.
Rob Herzog says, buy Bitcoin.
It's gone lower. So that's the same as, you know, great news from NVIDIA, stocks off. Everybody owns it. Who doesn't know about Bitcoin? So that would be my view. I mean, you know, but I'm not going to get an 8% dividend from Bitcoin, but I'm going to get it from ABN AMRO.
Witzer Post says, Sean, what are the chances of the whole U.S. market correcting by 50% within 12 months. Can investors sleep well for another while?
I mean, I don't know the answer. I mean, who knows? Can you sleep well? I wouldn't sleep well with 70% of my money in the U.S.
So how much money in the U.S. market would help you to sleep well?
Well, we've got just under 20.
Under 20.
And that's in supermarkets, largely. Okay.
Supermarkets
and
supermarkets.
Kroger and Albertsons and those kinds of companies. Okay. Yeah, because even if the poor boy hits the fan, you know, people are going to have to eat. And So, you know, but that's not a top-down view. It's and we've got companies like Skechers, which is a mid-cap, which are great businesses, you know, run by excellent management, etc. But they are not massively over-owned.
And Molson Coors?
Molson Coors we've got, you know.
Tell us about Molson Coors, South African audience.
Well, I mean, it's a very well-run business. And the one problem, sorry, and this is the other problem in the U.S., okay. The other problem in the U.S., I guess there's two problems. You have unbelievably, from what I can see, greedy management. I mean, there's a company called Big Lots, which is a big furniture store, and they were doing fabulously well for years. And I actually wrote a LinkedIn piece about it. I was incensed so much. But the CEO has been paying himself $9 million, and for the last 3 years, same-store sales have been falling, operating income's been falling, net income is sort of making losses, cash flow is quite poor. Still took $9 million, basically, okay, home as income. In the latest quarterly report, they warned of a going concern crisis in the quarterly report. Which means they might not make it.
See it through. Means they might
for the next year. They might not be around in the next year. Okay. 3 days later or whatever it was, there was an 8K, which is a filing, like a SENS announcement, that the CEO was given a $3 million. This is the CEO who drove this business into the ground, I would argue. Okay. Was given a $3 million cash payment. You know, it's like, please don't go anywhere else. I'm going, well, why would you not want him to go? Yeah, $3 million. The CFO, I think, was a million. The HR, et cetera. They paid these guys millions of dollars to stay, and yet they drove this business into the ground. It's bizarre. And meanwhile, they're about to close 20% of their staff. So you're about to fire thousands of workers, and the CEO is prepared to take $3 million in cash. It's disgraceful. And you see that, you know, I mean, NVIDIA bought back stock. Now, NVIDIA, I'm not painting the same, but I'm talking about the greed now. Running these businesses for management, okay? NVIDIA, two-thirds, so they bought back their shares, pretend they bought back 100 shares, and it's all in the latest quarterly report. Two-thirds of the shares that they bought back were effectively issued via new share options.
So effectively issued to people in the company.
Yeah.
They spent company money buying back shares and then took those shares and gave them...
Well, then gave them new share options. So the point being that when they're buying back stock, these tech companies are buying back stock, a large portion of that cash, okay, you're not returning money to shareholders because you're basically buying the stock back from your employees.
But it sounds like a bit of a shell game.
Well, no, the problem is investors value these businesses on free cash flow. And when you add back stock-based compensation, it suggests that there's no cost to giving these people options. But there is a cost if you're buying back those options from them. Okay, and that's what they're doing. So when you look at free... So actually, I think technology companies are way more expensive than people think they are because so much of the cash, you know, I'm buying back 100 shares, but actually I'm issuing a fresh 50. And that's what's going on. So, you know, I think whereas in Europe, you don't get that. You don't get that greed to the same extent. They've got more people on the board. They don't pay the CEOs as much as they do in the US. And I think that's a good thing.
It's really good listening to you, Sean, and opening our eyes to these things. I remember some years ago interviewing a CEO of a South African bank who, when I asked him about the share options that they were issuing, he said, no, but that doesn't cost anybody anything. The CEO of a South African bank said that at the time. Of course, now we're all educated to say, of course it's costing you because you're adding, you're dividing or you're taking away my share of the company by issuing more shares.
You're diluting.
You're diluting me. Michael says, given your comments on the USA, would you then avoid investing in mid-caps in the US?
Well, it depends which mid-caps, you know. I mean, that's the problem. That is the problem, is that which mid-caps? I mean, regional banks are considered mid-caps. Well, I wouldn't buy any regional banks in the US. Some utilities would be considered mid-caps, but I'm not about to buy over-indebted utilities companies in the US. You know, there are some real estate companies are over-indebted, and they'd probably be mid-caps. So, you know, it's which mid-caps? Skechers is a mid-cap, like Skechers. Okay, so you've got to be Molson Coors is a mid-cap. We like Molson Coors. So we've got to be selective.
Tell us a bit more about Molson.
Well, what was quite interesting about Molson Coors is that most of the company, many companies in the US, they, because interest rates were so low, they borrowed money. And in fact, that company, Big Lots, did a sale and leaseback and then used, they sold the company silver, got the money, used that money to buy back stock.
And as like Marcus has come to,
it's just a disaster. But here was Molson Coors. So what happened is when SAB Miller got acquired by AB InBev, there was, they had a joint venture in the US with Molson Coors. And that meant that Molson Coors, if there was ever any corporate takeover, Molson Coors could buy the share of the joint venture that they didn't own. So it's preemptive. Well, of course, they're the only buyer, so they got a good price. And they did that using debt. And so I think they paid kind of 9-10 times earnings, which means you're effectively investing a 10% return. And they funded that with debt. And then they've used the cash flow in recent years to repay that debt while interest rates were low. Well, that's quite savvy, because as soon as interest rates, you know, go up, you've got far less debt paying those high interest rates. So they've been very savvy about that. And then what happened is there was a bit of a marketing mess last year with Budweiser and the whole woke thing, and a lot of Republicans turned against them. And so they boycotted Bud Light. Well, that benefited Coors Light and it benefited Miller Light. And so what that meant is they then sold more beer. And of course, they made more money from that. And they could use that money to reinvest in marketing and keep gain market share. Meant they got better space in the supermarket shelves, which meant they got, you know, and it just fed on itself like that. So the management team's been quite astute. So we like that. You know, here you've got a company that is doing well. Beer, interestingly, is less exposed to private label than other people. You know, I come home, I might buy Waitrose Pasta or Asda Pasta or Sainsbury's Corn Flakes or whatever, but I'm not going to buy Sainsbury's beer. Okay, so beer is more insulated from the risk of private label, because in tough economies, people no longer buy the brands, they buy the private label brands. And it's probably one of the reasons, I mean, I think maybe why Box is doing well, I don't know. You know, some of these private labels, I don't know whether it's as big a thing down here as it is overseas, but some company like Carrefour sells nearly 40% of its products on their private label, their own brands, and they make more money. So, so we like Miller's Coors.
South African connection with Miller's Coors?
Well, the CFO and the CEO are South African, and they came out of SAB. And I think they've been doing a good job.
Good.
One other little thing there, Alex. So they used to import Peroni because they've got the license for Peroni in the States. But the problem is, you know, get shipped across, and now you've got Panama Canal issues and all the rest. So now with these extra profits, they've built a bottling plant and actually producing Peroni locally. So, you know, you get upside from a good brand like Peroni, which that says the beer's fresher, et cetera. So that's the kind of company we want. You want a nice stable business where I've got some growth potential, because we, you know, why did Microsoft go up? Its earnings went up. So we want businesses where earnings go up. Okay. We're not taking those last little puffs. We want growing businesses. Why we own Skechers? Well, because you think it's a growing business. We just don't want to pay too much for it, okay? So I've got some growth potential from Molson Coors. I've got a decent management team who seem to make the right decisions, sensible, conservative, and it's 10 times earnings or less than 10 times earnings. And I get a dividend, and they're now buying back stock. And because they've repaid as much debt as they think they need to. So that's the combo. Now, I'm exactly the same as Sai and Pete. Okay, I could change my mind tomorrow. If tomorrow they find out Peroni poisons people, I'm out. Okay? So you know, one needs to be, that's why I'm also not keen on talking about single stocks, because anything can happen. And even if you're the best investor in the world, you're going to get 3 or 4 out of 10 wrong. But
investing is the biggest game in the world. And we all like to play it in our own little way. And we like to research and we like to learn about these things. And we don't like to abdicate responsibility totally, even though we trust the people who are looking after it. And I think you've done us a huge service by saying, if you could get in a time machine and go back to the Maya Khan SAB and take the ethos, it even sounds like that. Miller's Light was theirs. Peroni was theirs. Well, there's the company. So why not have a little in your portfolio, thanks to Sean Pesh? Pitlow says, Sean, you are scaring us shitless. Reinvestment in the US. Should we take profits and stuff it in our sofas? Oh, yeah, Pete, come on. What are our options?
Pete's obviously not at the sleeping position. I don't know how exposed Pete is. And I think we all just need to understand that there are risks out there and you got to act ahead of the time. And maybe it means you leave a little bit of money on the table. But let me tell you this. So when I did a VAC job in 1992 at Seifert's Managed Assets, and Leon Kampfer was running the company at the time, and I went for coffee with him one day, and I thought, well, I don't have a lot of time, so I better sip my coffee slowly. But during that coffee, I said to him, Leon, what one bit of advice would you give me? Okay. And he said, always leave a little bit of money on the table for the next person, because they allowed you to take your risk off the table. And I've always remembered that. And so, you know, I like when we get what we think is maybe 80 to 90% of the juice of the lemon, let somebody else take the last 10%. They can end up with the pips all over their hands. Okay. Just get 80%. So maybe you take some profits and there's another 10% that carries on going up and you go, wish I hadn't been to that business investing conference. But, you know, maybe, but that's the, it's allowed you to take your risk off the table. And so I would just say, look, the world is a volatile place. We're in a sensitive time of the year. We're coming up to US elections. You know, there's lots of uncertainties and the market's expensive and it's time to be diversified. I really think it's time to be diversified. And so if you are scared to that extent, then it means you're not diversified.
Pretty wise man, Leon Kampfer. He told me something I also remember from him. And those of you who don't know, Leon and others at Seifert's Managed Assets went to the management of Seifert's, which was then owned by Nedbank, and they asked them if they could participate in bonuses, which was kind of what was starting to happen in the asset management field. And the Seifert's hierarchy said no. So they left and they started what is today Coronation Fund Management. Interesting. But Leon said to me, the two things in business that you must always guard against, just two things, arrogance and complacency. I love that. And it's funny how you remember little things that people tell you.
I tell you, he was an amazing manager. And I mean, here I was a VAC student and he came down to find me and thank me. You know, I mean, I was only there for 2 weeks. But I was quite taken by that. And so, yeah, so you can see why he did so well at Coronation.
No, and he saw something in you, Sean. Really? Yeah. Final question. Witzer says, Sean, about GM and Stellantis' CEOs, Mary Barra and Carlos Tavares, are giving themselves multi-million dollar pay increases while dealers' lots are overflowing and struggling to sell their vehicles. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, I don't know the specifics of those. We don't own those companies. But I guess it comes back to what I was saying a few minutes ago. I think the corporate compensation has got out of whack in the US. It really has. And I find it just staggering that boards can approve this. But you know, I mean, in the US, it's quite commonplace for non-executive directors to get share options. And you go, well, you know, the theory is, well, then they're aligned with shareholders. And you go, well, yeah, but they need to focus on the business, not the share price. And so I'd be disappointed. I think it's going to make, I'm sure that is true, it's going to make life difficult because things are tough in the auto industry right now. And negotiations with unions are going to be really challenging. And if I was a union leader, and the CEOs just to start a huge whacking grade increase to themselves, well, it's going to be an interesting negotiation because don't go fire my workers while you're paying yourself more, would be my stance. And so I think it's going to get nasty.
Well, we have wonderful treats outside for you to enjoy, plus tea and coffee. Then we have Don Lube to come and tell us about the gas opportunity in South Africa, and in particular, Kinetiko, which is in the BizNews portfolio, of which he's a big shareholder. You didn't even know it was in the portfolio, I'm sure. But anyway, a Kinetiko, I think that's what it's called. Then we've got Magnus, who is not as bearish, about South Africa as he was previously. So we've got a heck of a couple of hours before we go off and have pizza and wine at the golf club. Thank you, Short Pish. That was great fun.